Ten means teachings. Rim means steps. And Chemo means the great book on the steps of the teaching. We're going to study about Yidas from this book. And also later in the class, we're going to do Dundros, which are animals. Okay. So we're going to cover those two realms based on this book, Tenrim Chemo. Tenrim Chemo was written by Geshe Trolungpa. Say Geshe.
Geshe.
Trolungpa.
Trolungpa.
Geshe.
Geshe.
Trolungpa.
Trolungpa.
If you're new, I noticed a couple of new people tonight. You don't have to learn Tibetan. This is the English track. But I just want you to get a seat in your mind for Tibetan. And then someday you will learn it. I think about a quarter of the people in the Tibetan class thought they were going to take the English track. They ended up learning Tibetan. So someday you probably will. Geshe means spiritual friend. And in the early days of Tibetan Buddhism, it was really bad. It was just your individual spiritual guide. Much later in Tibet, it came to mean, it was a kind of degree given by monasteries. But early in the history of Buddhism, even in Sanskrit, it's called Kalyanamitra, which means spiritual guide, spiritual friend. Drolung is a place like Kansas. Drolungpa means like the guy from Kansas. So there was this Geshe from Drolung, and his name was Geshe Drolungpa. He lived, we don't know his dates. We know the exact dates of his teacher, we know the exact dates of his students, and we guess that he lived around 1100 AD. This book is 1,000 pages long. The Geshes of those days, who were called Kadampas, they didn't write any books, really. They wrote very, very little. They were mostly meditators. They were the first Buddhists in Tibet of our tradition. So I like to, whenever we can, it's good to study something that they wrote, but they didn't write much. They wrote mostly these two or three page things. Geshe Drolungpa, he wrote a huge presentation of all the steps of the Buddhist teachings, all the way from the beginning to the end. He wrote this huge text called Tenrim Chimo. Even in the days of Tsongkhapa, it was pretty rare. When did Tsongkhapa live?
Okay.
We called Jay Tsongkhapa. And he lived... Jay Tsongkhapa is generally considered the greatest master ever to be produced in Tibet. He wrote 10,000 pages of commentaries. If you ever try to read one of them, you'll be lucky to make it through the whole thing in a few years, seriously. And he wrote 10,000 pages of these things. They say he was just taking dictation from Manjushri. And you believe it if you learn Tibetan and try to read his works. You believe it, because they're just incredibly deep, packed, difficult to read, and incredible. And you can't believe that a human being could write them. Jetsun Kapa is probably the greatest master ever produced out of Tibet, except for our root lama. No joke. But he wrote a book called the Lamrim Chemo, which is the great book on the steps of the what? Anything look similar? I mean, basically he's just taking Geshe Drolungpa's book, and, you know, which is good writing in Tibet, because basically the lama in front of you was probably his lama, or his lama was omniscient. They knew everything. So you don't have to write a new book. You can just rearrange the books from before and you're a great Buddhist author. That's okay. The same with painting. We don't change the Buddha's face. We don't change his look. It's not considered a virtue with spiritual things to change them. It's a virtue to take the same elements and present them to your culture in a certain way, but you never change them. So basically, we've come to think that Jetson Kappa, we know that he bumped into this book 6 years before he wrote the Lamrim Chemo. It's interesting. So he basically took that book and rearranged it, and it became, this is the greatest book ever written in Tibetan probably. And probably no one will be able to write anything greater now. Tibetan language is degenerating. It's being lost in the world. The Tibetans in Tibet who are still living there can hardly speak Tibetan anymore. The Tibetans in India don't speak Tibetan very well, can't read very well. the Tibetans in China can't read Tibetan at all, but when they come to the monastery in India, they have to relearn how to read. So probably I think this will be the great, the masterwork of Tibetan literature. So I think it's really great to study this book. This book was lost for a long time. His Holiness found one copy in Siberia about 15 years ago. And it was a very bad copy. You couldn't read it very well. And then we located one about 5 years ago. So now we have a beautiful copy. So I think it's cool that you get to read it. So we took the reading from this book. And it's been put out to CD-ROM now, and it's going to be given away all over the world. So I think it's cool that you get to read from the Tenrin Chenmo. So your reading is from this Tenrin Chenmo, which Jetsun Khapa used to write the greatest book ever written in Tibet. So you're very honored to be the first people to read from there. And Geshe Drolongpa gives a very good presentation of on Yidang. He says there are four main causes for Yidang. One general cause and three specific causes. I'll give you the general cause first. If you want to be born as a Yidang, do the 10 bad deeds to medium strength. Okay. What does medium strength mean? I mean, this is just a general... What are the 10 bad deeds? I mean, first of all... Yeah, I mean, go like that. Killing. Treat with your body. Killing.
Stealing.
Sexual misconduct, mainly adultery, but including other sexual kinds of... There's a long list, sexual misconduct. Then four kinds in your speech, which are...
Lying.
Slander meaning talk that splits other people up. We don't have a good word in English. Divisive speech. And then?
Harsh words.
Harsh words can be sweet words said in a bad way, right? Or with bad intent, but they hurt somebody. And then, fourth one in speech?
I don't talk.
Like just wasting time talking. So that's, so far you got seven. And then there's three in your mind, three that you do in your mind, which are what? Coveting, which is basically an inward, you know, you basically want things that other people have. You're jealous of them and you're trying to get the things that other people have. Number nine?
Malice.
So people call malice or ill will. It means being happy when other people screw up, basically. And last one?
Wrong view.
Wrong view, mainly, there's no future life. There's no such thing as karma. I mean, if no one sees me do something, there'll be no effect. You know, if I do something bad in the privacy of my own room and nobody knows about it, there won't be any bad effect from that. Those are the basic ten bad deeds. Those are an abbreviation of how many?
84,000.
I mean, the Buddha said, and the Abhidharma says, okay, it's 84,000 bad deeds, and yeah, roughly you can group them into 10 so that human beings can remember them at least. There are that many. If you do them to medium strength means, like, very light strength would be if you, for example, broke minor vows over and over again, or something like that. Heavy strength would be if you premeditated, intentional, took a long time to prepare the weapon, in a great state of hatred over a long period of time, and then went and killed somebody. And that person was some kind of maybe holy person, you know, like the Dalai Lama or something. That would be a heavy one. Medium means somewhere between there. Okay? So medium strength is like that. To do those 10 bad deeds in medium strength is the general cause to be born as a preta. That's just the whole general cause. Then there are like three very specific attitudes that can get you born as a preta. You don't have to know the Tibetan. I'm just trying to plant it. Okay? Say Jimba.
Jimba.
Namsum.
Namsum.
Majimba.
Majimba.
Jimba.
Jimba.
Namsum.
Namsum.
Majimba.
Majimba.
Jimba. What's Jimba mean?
Jimba.
Yeah. That's his name. Giving. Okay. Jimba is the first paramita, for example. Giving. Okay. The act of giving. Jimba. Namsum means it's the same as Lamso Namsum. What's that?
Three times.
Yeah, it means the three types. The three types. Majimba means not giving. So the first cause to be born as a preta is failing to give the three types of giving. Okay?
failing to give the three types of giving. What are the three types of giving? The Dharam Chamo doesn't say, but you can look it up in other books. And they are, say, Sang Singhi,
Sangsingi,
Jimba.
Jimba.
Sang Singhi,
Sangsingi,
Jimba.
Jimba.
Sang Singhi means material wealth, you know, like houses, beds, food, drink, things like that. Material stuff, physical things. Okay. The things that people need to live. Jimba means the giving of those things. So the first kind of giving, and in fact the lowest kind of giving, is to give people shelter, food, bed, things like that. That's called Sansingi Jimba. Second kind is, say Minjikpe.
Minjikpe.
Jimba.
Jimba.
Minjikpe.
Minjikpe.
Jimba.
Jimba.
Okay. Who's Jigje? Yamataka, Bhanava, okay? But it means the fierce, the frightener, the frightener. So Minjikpa means, Minjikpa means what? Me? Not to be frightened. So Minjikpa means not to be frightened. Jigpa means giving. The giving of not to be frightened. What's it mean? It means protection. Okay? The Lamrim Chimo says, protecting people from muggers, wars, other threats to their lives. The Namdo Lakchan, the liberation in our hands, by Prabhupada Rinpoche says, don't think that you have to be in the UN to give Minjikpe Jimba. Doesn't say UN, okay? But it says, you can give Minjikpe Jimba to a flea that's walking across your arm. You know, if you just pick it up carefully and put it on the side instead of smashing it, you just made the gift of Minjikpa. You just gave the gift of protecting somebody from harm, from fear. Okay, so Minjikpe Jimba is basically protecting people from dangerous things, things that would harm them. And that's the second kind of giving. Third kind of giving, say Chirki.
Chirki.
Jimba.
Jimba.
Chirki.
Chirki.
Jimba.
Jimba.
What's Chir?
Dharma.
Dharma, okay. Chir is Dharma. Here meaning Dharma teachings. Okay. Dharma teachings. And Jimba is giving. Chirki Jimba. That's the gift of the Dharma, teaching someone Dharma. That's the highest kind of teaching, highest kind of giving. Because let's say all this stuff that I'm saying today is true. Let's say that I can convince you what would make you be born as a preta in your next life, which could be 10 minutes from now. You know? Let's say that somehow I can convince you that such a thing is possible. And let's say that somehow I can show you what causes it and you avoid that and it saves you from being born as a yidam, as a preta. Then that'd be a lot more important than these kinds of giving. That would be some kind of incredible kind of giving. So, you know, assuming that what we're going to say tonight is true, assuming it sinks in to you, then it could protect you even tonight from not being born as a preta, if you get hit by a car on the way home. Okay. So that's the highest kind of giving. So the first cause of being born as a preta is to fail to give these three kinds. If someone needs them, you have to give them. And you have to try. And there's a lot of things to say about that. There's gray areas, you know. Do you give a guy at the subway a dollar if he asks you for alcohol or something? We're not talking about that. We're talking about cases where mainly you know that it's right to give the thing. The person needs it very much. You have it, and maybe you even have it in excess, and you just don't give it because you're lazy or you're angry or you ignore the person or you don't care about the person or something like that. Or worst of all, you have some kind of possessiveness about the thing. You don't want to see the things that you own get less. You want to protect what you own. That kind of possessiveness is the main cause of being born as a preta. Did you have a question?
Is there a reason why giving protection is a higher type of giving than giving material things?
I you know, that's why I hesitated when I said this was the lowest. Because I don't remember any particular order between these two. Yeah. I know that this one is higher. But I'm not sure if there's any... I'm not sure that number two is higher than number one.
When you talk about the general cause, is it any of the 10 deadly
sins? Yeah, done to a medium extent.
How many times you do them?
We'll talk about it.
Okay, there are four causes. The first cause is general deeds, and then...
There's three specific ones.
The three specific ones within...
No, not within. This is only one general one. Okay?
Okay.
And now this is the first of the specific ones. I got two more to give you.
Okay.
Okay? I got two more to give you.
So that is number two out of the four?
Yeah.
Okay.
Or the first of the specifics.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. Now I'm going to give you number two specific cause. All right. There you go. Second specific cause is called Senna. Say Senna.
Senna.
Senna. I don't know a good, nice word in English, but it means being a cheapskate. Okay. It means being cheap. It's a very specific for a tightwad. Okay, somebody who doesn't like to, somebody who's, you know, hangs on to what they own and doesn't want to share it with anybody. You can say miserliness. I don't know. Cheapness is too colloquial and miserliness is too literary, and I don't know anything between. You know, stingy is pretty good. You know, stinginess. Serna is stinginess. That's the classic cause that they often talk about in books, this Serna. Okay. Again, it's some kind of possessiveness. It's not wanting to see what you own get less. It's this misconception that protecting your wealth is the best way to keep it. Say chato.
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 Chato means jealousy. Okay. Jealousy. It's a very sick attitude for a Dharma person to have. You know, you're supposed to be a bodhisattva. Your whole life is supposed to be aimed at seeing that other people get what they want and that other people are happy. And chato, when it looks at someone else's happiness, wishes that they didn't have it. You know, it's a very sick state of mind. I have it a lot, so I understand it. Okay, but it's, you know, you're supposed to be on the lookout for all sentient beings. And then when somebody gets the little thing like a promotion at work, or a little more money, or has more Dharma students than you, or something like that, you feel this chagdo. You know, you feel bad about that. You wish they didn't have that. So it's like the complete opposite of the whole Buddhist philosophy. And that's that we have it over all this, every little thing. We have chagdo all the time.
So you wish that they don't have it. But
yeah, it's not wanting to possess it yourself necessarily. It's just this, it's being irritated that other people have success and wealth and the good things that they want and not enjoying that, but the opposite, being some kind of hatred about it. It's a weird state of mind. It's a very sick state of mind. Chato. Okay. And those are the three main causes, specific causes for being born as a threat. I think here we have to talk about what's the process. I mean, it's almost like voodoo to say, hey, if you're jealous, you're going to end up as the spirit being that you can't see anyway. You know, I mean, it's very hard for Westerners, and I think it's good that it's hard. You know, it's hard for us to see the connection between being, you know, failing to give something because we feel possessive, and then after we die, being born into this spirit being that we've never seen, no one's ever proven it, there's no pictures or videos of them, and so I'm supposed to believe this guy who's standing up there that if I'm jealous of somebody at work, then after I die I'm going to be born as this thing. It sounds like the religion I grew up with that I rejected, you know, they're threatening you with something, that there's this guy up in heaven who's going to punish you, and it sounds like the same spiel, I think. So I think you have to talk about how could that happen? You know, is there any logical way to show that it could happen? I think at this point, if you're talking about yidax, you have to study, you have to think about the four principles of karma. So I'm going to give you the four principles of karma. If you were in the karma course, you already know them perfectly. But I'll give you the four, okay? Say, lengepa.
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 Okay, good. It's the first principle of karma. But first of all, I ask you, and we went through this a little bit on Friday, I think, but what's the most basic kind of karma? What is the essence of karma?
It's the movement of the mind.
Yeah, he said the movement of the mind. Abhidhamma Kosha, 4th chapter, opening minds. Which means, if you want to know where the universe came from and all the planets in it, it's from karma. What is karma? It's any time your mind twitches. Anytime your mind goes from here to here, it's karma. That is the essence of karma. That's what karma really is. An action or a deed or karma is anytime your mind just shifts, that's a karma. You just did a karma. Okay? Then what you say and what you do with your body are secondary. You know, first you think of something and then you open your mouth to say something. And then you move your arms or your legs to do something, good or bad. But the essence of karma is when the mind just shifts a little bit. How many times does the mind shift in the length of a finger now? Semotopa. Semotopa in Tibetan. 64 times in that amount of time. Your mind is lightning fast. Your mind is going through 64 sembas. 64 twitches in that amount of time. That's called Jantoki Kechigma. 64 of them going on. Yeah.
Does that correspond to
I don't know. I mean, if Serge was here, he could tell us. But I think probably like that many electrons moving a certain distance, probably. I mean, electrons are pretty fast, right? And maybe it does, I think. But basically, you can think that you're collecting 64 karmas in that much time. That's the essence of karma. Where does karma stay until you get the result? We had a long course about it, but basically those movements of the mind are making impressions on your mind. They're making imprints on your mind. And they stay with you. The imprint is made and they stay with you. A lot has to do with your intentions and a lot has to do with how you perceive the event. In other words, when you perceive yourself doing something good or bad, it makes an impression in your mind. And that is impressed in your mind stream. The mind does go on in a stream, and certain things impress the mind. If the content of the impression was good, you will always have a good result. If the content of the impression was bad, you will always have a bad result. There's never any cross like that. It's always good makes good and bad makes bad. Okay? And that's the first principle of karma. The content is fixed. The content is fixed. What does that mean? It means if you hurt somebody, you'll get a bad result. If you help somebody, you'll get a good result. Absolutely fixed. It never goes any other way. It never goes like, do something good, get something bad. Do something bad, get something good. It's impossible. So what happens, Jimba? I work in the diamond business. I lie to some guy about what I can really pay. I can pay 100. I tell him 90 is all I can pay. And he, because of my skillful lie, which is what the diamond business is sometimes about, he gives it to me for 100 and for 90. So I made $10. Is the $10 a good thing? Yeah, I mean, getting $10 more than you had before, for most people, is a pleasant experience. That's the definition of the result of good karma. The definition of the result of good karma is getting something that you like. It's the definition of good karma. Any deed which has a karmic result, gives you something you like, that's good karma. So I got a result of a good karma, right? But it came from lying, right? It did?
Yes.
Oh, no.
Because good deed, it is in the past time.
Yeah, I mean, or yeah, in the past sometime. Yeah. Could be in this life, could be in the past life. I mean, the $10, trust me, didn't come from the lie. It's impossible. If the $10 came from the lie, then the Buddha was lying when he gave this first principle of karma. It can't. Lying to someone is a bad deed. It hurts people. Getting $10 is a nice result. They're not connected. They're just not connected. And therein lies the suffering of mankind. You know, we think that to get nice things, we should do something like lying. And it's just not true. It's a big lie. It's a big coincidence that We get the $10 right after we lie. That's not where the $10 came from. It's absolutely not. The $10 came from being generous to someone in the past. The lie is going to create a bad result. You know, in the future, you'll tell the truth and people won't believe you. Why? Why is it that some people tell the truth and nobody believes them? Then, and then some politicians get up and lie their heads off and everybody's like impressed and boastful. Why? You know why? Why is that? It's a past karma. It's a result of past karma. And you have to see it like that. It's very interesting. Here's the lie, and it's going to create a bad result. Well, you got to say like that, right? And here's the money that you got, right? And that's caused by being generous over here. And then because these two things seem to happen in the same time frame, you think they're connected, but they're not. Okay. You do not get money from lying. Cannot. Never will. That's the first principle of karma. It sometimes there's a coincidence and it looks like that. I mean, if all mankind understood this, there'd be no cheating. Everybody'd be honest to each other. Everybody'd be totally honest. Everybody would be happy. Everybody would be getting lots of money all the time. But the total economic level of the planet would be very high. I mean, it's not necessary that some people have to be poor and some people have to be rich. Everybody could be rich. There's just the problem of not recognizing how this works. That's laying the empire. Do you have a question?
It was with regards to your illustration. Yeah. The person expected you to lie. Is it really? I mean, you know, in the sales.
That's a different thing. I mean, if it's part of that culture. Yeah. I mean, in negotiation, I think it's a very, very. I mean, lying means giving the other person a misconception, creating a misconception in the other person's mind. Most of the time, in the diamond business, God doesn't believe you anyway.
Okay.
I don't want to. Okay. Minor fancy. But generally, just it'd be pleasant if everyone just told the truth, and we wouldn't have to worry about whether they're lying.
Sometimes people motivation as well, or skillful means is flawed, and it turns out the best intentions they do something wrong. Or
the main thing is intention. Intention is 90% of the karmic result. I mean, we don't have time tonight for a class in karma, but we did it for 6 or 8 weeks before. You can get the tapes from John Stillwell. Okay, second principle of karma. By the way, it's a very nice way to live your life. Think of what that little drawing of the two, the happy face and the sad face. I mean, just believe it, and you'll be a lot happier. Things will start, you'll start to get more money. People start to believe you, you know. Really, seriously, it comes. It will happen. Just try it. You know, just be totally honest and follow those 10 good deeds. You'll get the results. Say, Pelchewa.
Pelchewa.
Pelchewa means gets bigger. I always tell the story, and I apologize to the older students who already heard it 20 times. I live in a Mongolian temple in New Jersey. It's surrounded by these huge oak trees, and it must be 100 feet high or something. Very, very massive, very heavy. And one day there was a big storm and one of them fell on top of our temple and it was like made a hole in the roof. And so the Mongolians all came to look at it and they said, Michael, you get up there. I was like 20 years old, very naive. And here's a chainsaw, you go out and cut those branches off, you know. And I don't like heights and I'm not very brave. So I'm up there on this tree cutting off the limbs of this heavy chainsaw. It's waving around and I start cursing this tree and thinking, you know, what if when it was an acorn, like 20, I don't know how long it takes, 40 years ago, I see these acorns out on the road sometimes. It's asphalt, right? So what if 40 years ago somebody had taken that acorn and thrown it out on the asphalt, and it was sitting in the middle of the asphalt, and it never grew, you know? And it never got planted, and it never had a sprout, and it never grew into this huge 150-foot tree, I wouldn't be up here, you know? And it kept coming to my mind over and over again like that. And then you think about, I mean, in physical world, it's true, and you can't deny it. The acorn's weight is what? I don't know. The weight of an acorn is maybe, I don't know, a few grams. I don't know. It's like, I don't know how many grams, 10 grams or something, you know, like an ounce. And then the weight of that tree is what? It's a ton or 2 tons. I don't know what it is. Huge. Did one create the other? I mean, the seed, the acorn was the seed for the tongue. The ounce was the seed for the tongues. I mean, the nature of causes, the nature of seeds in the physical world, you were made from the one cell of your father and the one cell of your mother. I mean, this 40, 50, 60 years of cells running around New York was made by just one cell of your mother and one cell of your father. Infinitely small. No weight at all. And the physical world is like that. You can see that, you understand that. I mean, things like the United States of America start with two people having a discussion one day over a table somewhere, you know, and then it becomes this thing. And the same thing happens with karma. I mean, you have the slightest thought now, and it becomes a huge entity later. That's the nature of karma. It's the nature of ideas. You know, a single idea becomes this huge motivating force throughout the world for millions and millions of people. You know, one person has one idea, teaches it to somebody, and then eventually it's this huge idea throughout the world. Or you yourself, as you're, you know, you're 10 years old, you have one inkling of a bad habit, and then by the time you're 30, it's like controlling your whole life. You know, I mean, they start very, very tiny. Mental things and physical things are the same. So the other principle of karma is the slightest good deed or bad deed becomes huge. The results are huge. You can think of like one gene. There was a woman in this class who's not here tonight because she's pregnant and her baby is missing a gene, you know, a branch of a gene or something. You know, so like they decided that this child might have some horrible diseases and be mutated, etc., because they're just missing a little, one of 13 genes or something, you know, one little branch fell off of the cells. And that's the way karma is. Karma is extremely volatile. Karma is extremely dangerous. The smallest tiny thought in your mind, one of those 64 instants, can become a huge result in the future. That's one of the principles of karma. Yeah.
I always wonder, because in the physical world, things also decay and get smaller, and they never talk about bad karma.
We're getting there. We're getting there. If I don't cover it by the next one, no. By the way, with that particular lady, they figured out that it didn't matter. Don't feel bad. I apparently. She went, she had a big scare, and then it didn't. It came back or something like that. Seriously. I mean, they figured out it was a bad sample of tissue. She was pretty freaked out.
What is the English for pelchewa? It
gets bigger. I mean, infinitely bigger, like the acorn and the tree. Say machepa.
Machepa.
Dang.
Dang.
Machepa.
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 Dang.
Machepa.
Machepa.
Say machepa dang.
Machepa.
Machepa.
Machepa
dang.
Machepa.
If you don't do a karma, you'll never get any result from it. If you throw the acorn out on the asphalt, you don't have to go up with a chainsaw. Okay. Really. Seriously. Very simple. If you can avoid a bad deed, you'll never get the result. You just won't get it.
What if you did nothing to that suffering?
Excuse me?
What if you did nothing to that suffering?
That's like the first specific cause of being born as a person. Right? Say chepa.
Chepa.
Ch.
Ch.
Isao.
Isao.
Chepa.
Chepa.
Ch.
Ch.
Isao.
Isao.
If you do it, it never just goes away. How is karma planted in your mind? I mean, karma doesn't stay out in your Pluto or those other new planets and then come back to you. It stays very intimately with you. It's planted in your mind stream, and it can go on for thousands of years in your mind stream. We talked about it in the Course on Karma. The process is that it replicates itself. It is destroyed by the instant, like all changing things, like our body, or this house, or New York City. It's changing from instant to instant, but the energy is being transferred to the next instant. So, it doesn't just go away. That seed stays in your mind. The fact that it's destroyed by the instant doesn't mean that it doesn't continue. It does continue. and it stays in your mind. It stays in your mind until the day it gives you a result. So just to put it briefly, it's like you see somebody need something really bad, like a friend of yours really needs something that you have. And there's nothing that could prevent you from giving it except you're just too stingy. You know, they need it, you have it, it's not like it's your last one. You know, you're just lazy or you're stingy. And you perceive yourself not giving it to them. And you're aware of your own stinginess. Like you have an intention and you think about it and you decide not to give this thing to them because you want to have more. You know, you don't want to see your bank account go down. So you don't give it to them. But the whole process of being aware of yourself as you don't give it and as you think about protecting your own, very horrible. I mean, the way it gets planted is, it just slips by. We don't notice it. You know, you notice the really bad deeds because they disturb your heart. But these are like things that just slip on day by day. You keep doing them. You're not even aware of collecting the karma. You just didn't give it to them when they needed it. And that being aware of yourself at that moment is what plants it. It plants it in your mind stream. And then later, it flowers in your mind stream. How it flowers, we talked about a lot. But basically, it flowers as a perception that you don't have enough money. You know, it comes out as a perception that you yourself don't have enough of what you need. And in extreme form, it manifests itself as perceiving yourself as some kind of being who can't even get anything to eat or drink. You know, and in an extreme form, because karma gets more violent, you know, karma is like this virulent germ that starts out little tiny thing, and then eventually it ruins you. And then you actually have an awareness of being this kind of being who can't even get anything to drink or eat. And then on top of that, you have some kind of it has this secondary result of making you want more than you can ever get. So you have this craving for more and more, on one hand, and then on the other hand, you can never satisfy it. You know, you feel this extraordinary kind of desire for something to eat and drink. And then on the other hand, you, because of your own mind and your own perceptions, you can't find it. And then you have this horrible kind of creature called a preta. And they have these conflicting energies going on. On one side, they want more and more and more. They're more and more hungry and dissatisfied. And then on the other side, everywhere they go, they can't find anything. And it's just an extreme flowering of this perception that you planted long ago when you didn't give somebody something they needed. And what I'm trying to say is, I'm trying to show you how the process works. It's not like this guilt trip that there's a guy up there with his long scroll keeping track of your bad deeds. By perceiving yourself do something wrong regarding giving, you will have to perceive yourself be that kind of being, period. And it's a psychological event. It's not some kind of, you know, how does karma, where does it stay? How does it work? That's how it works. It works in your own mind. And when the time comes, you will be this kind of being who's overwhelmed with desire, needs something, and can't find anything. And then it just spends its life like that, in this horrible feeling of wanting, 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 and not being able to get anything. And they spend their whole life, they say that they run around, they just race from here to there looking for things, and they can never find them. It's like this, I don't know how to say it, it's like this horrible result, which is a million times heavier than the cause that caused it. And it's all your perceptions. And that's why it can happen to us. That's why. And the process of dying is the point at which it's called chupasipa. It's the 10th link of the wheel of life. But that process of dying and passing over that threshold makes those karmas more powerful, and then they come back to you as a birth. And then you perceive yourself as this kind of being that can't get what it wants. It's craving all the time, running back and forth, and never satisfied. That's how it works. Is it so? I don't know if you get sort of more of a feeling that it could happen to you. You know, it could happen to you if you can perceive yourself doing one of those three specific causes. Then you will perceive yourself be that kind of being. That's why it's possible. It's not that, you know, you kind of grow into this gremlin, your arms fall off, and suddenly you become this kind of little gremlin. It's that your perception shift. And they will. They can. Three quick questions, then we'll take a break. You were for a second.
Okay. If I am a very stingy person,
yeah,
but I think of myself as generous, say I'm in denial,
yeah,
okay? There's even one possibility, versus I am stingy and I know I'm stingy.
Yeah.
Does this make a difference or not?
It does. It makes a big difference. If the intention, the example that you can quote, sort of the Abhidharma Kosha's fourth chapter, where someone perceives that their father or mother has cancer or something, and is having this horrible time, you know, has terminal cancer, and out of mercy, out of thoughts of mercy, they killed him. Okay, it's a terrible bad deed. I mean, it's a really wrong deed, and you will get a horrible result from it. But the motivation, the intention is pure. It's like a right intention. So we say that the karmic result of that will be a mixture. The karmic result of the intention is some kind of incredible good result. The karmic result of the deed is some kind of incredibly bad result.
How can you determine the intention? I mean, like you...
You can meet the person. The intention is to help them. Your intention... What defines a good intention? If you wish to help someone, that's a good intention.
Well, often people want to help, they hurt others.
That's what I'm saying. It's what we call a mixed white and black karmic deed. It's called karna deva, mixed white and black. But you got to study karma, it's a long subject. We did a whole couple months on it, yeah.
An example you just said was about something not regarding yourself, like you and your parent, but like, it almost sounds to me like, so it's karmically better to not even be aware when I'm angry, because then I don't perceive myself being angry. So
when I say perceive, it's just you do perceive yourself being angry. You're not aware that you're perceiving yourself being angry. How about that? Something like that. I mean, there's this... It is a bad deed to be angry, whether you even... I mean, they take the example in the Abhidharma of a crazy person. I mean, is insanity a good defense in Buddhism? Yes. You don't know what you're doing. Is it still a bad deed? Yes. No, but it's a lot less than if you were fully aware of what you were doing was wrong. They say that that's why Rinpoche hasn't taught us a lot of the other higher balance. And they say it's better you don't know that you're breaking them. If you would break them, then you'd be higher balance.
In order to become this spirit, is this a new time to know?
I don't like how you started the question. In order to perceive yourself becoming this spirit, which is what happens. That's why it's possible. That's why it's totally plausible that this could happen to us.
Is this a one-time thing? Behavior that you have to get pretty engaged that leads you to this perception? Or is it more or less continual behavioral pattern? In other words, is it a continual thing, or is it one?
The whole fourth chapter of the Abhidharma deals with these questions, you know. Is it multiple karmas that leads to one rebirth? Or could one karma lead to multiple rebirths? And the answer is both. There are cases when you do something minor continually, for example, would make you be born as an animal. But one very powerful action of you know, someone's dying for a dollar and you don't give it to them, well then you could take multiple births as a prayer. Take a break, have some nice tea and... there's a tea downstairs, and then come back in like 10 minutes. The first one is called... Say, Chi.
Chi.
Jibachen.
Jibachen.
Chi.
Chi.
Jibachen.
Jibachen.
Chi means outside, on the outside. Jibachen means obstacle, having an obstacle. So, the first kind of prayer is the kind that has obstacles on the outside. Outside obstacles. What that means is that being is perceiving themselves as extremely hungry and thirsty. And that being has, on top of that, an added desire, I mean, this incredible craving for something to drink, and they can't find anything. And then they see from a distance, they see this beautiful lake, you know, from a distance. And they're always running. I mean, they spend their whole lives running. And they see this lake of beautiful water, and they run. You know, they put their head down and they run. And then they get up to the side of the lake, and they look down, and it's turned into blood and pus and excrement. I mean, it's just turned into something horrible. And that's the story of their life. You know, these kind of pretas, they have some kind of karma. Again, the whole thing is just your mind shifting. Your mind has not given the things to other people that they need. So your mind shifts, and as you approach that water, it's something else by the time you get up to it. It turns into something else. Is the water turning into something else? What's happening? Your mind is shifting. Okay? Your mind is shifting. By the way, every change in the world, from the movement of my hand to the sun coming up, which we studied in the Diamond Sutra, it's all just a shift in your perception. So, I'm not moving my hand, okay? Your mind is shifting. But that explains how a being could walk up to some water and suddenly they look down and it's just blood. They can't drink it anymore. It's just pus or something disgusting. It's a shifting of their mind. Yeah.
So it's not necessarily the physical, like you said in the lecture before, that pretas can have a subtle physical form. That would mean that they live in a certain subtle physical realm.
We'll talk about it. We'll get there. It'll come. So those are the first kind of pretas. The next one is called Nangi Dukkacitta. Yeah.
Would you say then that a preta has a perception from afar, which is pleasing or somehow appealing to them?
Yeah, that appears to be a good karma. That's a result of a good karma. That they don't see this blood in the first place. Say, Nangi
Dipachen.
Nangi
Dipachen.
The only difference here is Nangi. Nangi means on the inside. So instead of having obstacles on the outside, they have obstacles on the inside. This is this... this is this thing where their mouth is very small. They say as small as the hole on a needle, and that their intestines are very thin, and their gullet, their throat, and they say the size of a guitar string, and then their bellies are huge. So even if they could get something to eat or drink, they can't stuff it down fast enough to ever be satisfied. You know, and you see pictures on the Wheel of Life, and you say, that's cute, that looks like the Gremlin movie I saw, or something like that. And you just think it's some kind of folk tradition in Tibet that these beings must exist. It's not like that. It's the natural perception that a being would have if they spend this life being unsatisfiable. It's the natural karmic evolution, explosive growth of constant feelings of possessiveness in this life. And it's possible, because again, it's a perception. Is it therefore not real? No way. It's totally real, because it's a perception. We'll talk about that sometime. It's as real as anything in this world.
So are those beings actually able to consume things that aren't reviling? Is it the end?
That's number three.
Oh. Can number two consume anything?
No. Nope. I mean, they can try. They say that their mouths are flaming with fire. And if somehow they get a little bit down, there's this karma that they're never satisfied. It doesn't matter how much they try to stuff in. They have this karma that they never find any happiness. You see human beings who have a touch of death. You know, I mean, most of us. You know, no matter how much you get, you still want something bigger or better or more. You know, I used to be very happy with $6 an hour at my work, and then it was 7, then it was 8, and then it was 50, and then it was 100, and, you know, you'll never finish. Say, Sekongi,
Dipachen.
Sekongi,
Dipachen.
Sekong means food and drink. Food and drink. Dipachen means having obstacles for food and drink. So, in the scripture, or in the Denrim of Geshe Kolumba, it says that these beings, they have a problem that even if they get some kind of food, like they finally get a glass of water that doesn't turn into pus or blood, okay? And they drink it, but on the way down it just burns them. They have this feeling of being burned. It's like drinking molten steel or something. And the minute it starts going down their throat, it feels like acid. feels like acid going down my throat. And then I told you wrong. And this is the category where no, even if it gets down, it never satisfies them. It's like someone who could eat all day and still feel hungry.
So what is number two then?
Number two is more like a physical impediment where their mouths are just too small and their stomachs are just too big and they can never fill it up. They couldn't get physically enough food down to ever fill it up. And then number three is more like it burns as it goes down, and then even if it gets down, it never satisfies them. They still feel hungry and thirsty all the time.
What is the English description for this being?
These are all pretas.
No, I mean the third being?
The wording is those with obstacles to food and drink. Meaning there's a bad reaction to the food and drink that they can get. So I guess the third category is lucky, they can get something, but it either hurts them or it doesn't satisfy them. The first two kinds can never get anything anyway, or they can't get enough.
But why don't they die? I mean, if they can't satisfy, they never get anything to eat and drink.
That's like in the hell. She says, why don't they die if they don't get enough? It's your karma. There's a hell called Vibhaya. It's called Yangtze. And in that hell, you're born there, and somebody just stands there and beats you with a club until you die. And then there's this sound from the sky comes Yangtze, and you get back up, and they beat the crap out of you again, and you die. And then the sound comes from the sky and says Yangtze, and you get back up. You just revive. You know, you just keep coming back to life. It's like a zombie or something. And it's your karma to keep living. They say that the lifespan of these beings is, they say that a day in their lives passes in the time of a month on this, in our realm. And that's typical. In the lower realms, time passes more slowly. So like a day in the life of a preta is a month for a human being. And they say that these beings, I believe, you can check the reading, but I believe it's 500 days is the maximum life of a preta, according to the Tendu.
500 days?
Yeah, but their days. Yeah. Which times 30, okay? I don't know what that is. 15,000 days.
Maybe 500 months.
Then they die again. So then they die. So that's the longest the lifespan is. How big are they? They say it's not fixed. Their bodies are not fixed. Where do they live? There's two main places. One is supposed to be below this planet, below the Earth, and so many miles away from our where we live. And then there's a certain category of preta that's living among us, and we can't see them. And the scriptures said that at night maybe you can sometimes catch a glimpse of them. But there are yidas. There are pretas, according to scripture, running around us, and we can't see them. That's why sometimes when you do a puja or an offering, you put something out for them. And then if you do the right kind of prayer, they can actually partake of it, something like that. So don't think it's some kind of, this chapter is very unpopular. I mean, if you're one of those lamas who came and gave a two-day teaching in New York City, you wouldn't want to cover this. It's not very sexy, you know. It's not as good as like a 10 empowerment or something. I shouldn't say that. It's probably just broken what he's talking about. But anyway, the point is that it's because it's a mental perception, it's very possible that it could happen to us. I just want to say that it's very plausible that it could happen to us. It's just the natural growth of a feeling of possessiveness in this life, which starts out the size of an acorn, could, if it had a genetic flaw, grow into some huge, grotesque oak tree in 100 years from now. If the mind is eternal, which it is, you know, if the mind will go on forever, which it does, and we can prove that, then if you plant a tiny defective seed in it in 1996, then it makes good. It's possible that in 2030, even if you're not in this life where you are, it's going to come out with some horrible result. It's very possible. That result won't be some little gremlin body that someone shoves you into that. It will be a perception of that seed flowering in your own mind, and you look down and you have that body, and those things are happening to you, and it will happen. And that, you know, supposedly if you really understand all this, you don't want to collect those causes anymore. You know, you just absolutely don't want to be stingy anymore. You don't want to be jealous anymore. You know, if you get very good at this, you'll feel seeds being planted in your mind as you do bad deeds at the office. Okay, you will be you'll get the sensation of planting a bad seed in your mind and being sorry about it, because once they're in there, it's very hard to get them out. Like, so if you get good at your practice, you'll have the sensation of a seed being planted in your mind, and then realizing that you can't go back 5 minutes and take it back. It's already planted in the mind stream. It's a very nasty thing. You've got to be very careful not to let them get planted.
How do these things acquire the karma you need to become
extremely unlikely.
What was the question?
She wanted to know, how could they ever come back up? You know, because in that life, they're not being generous either. I mean, they're just being worse. You know, like birds. Somebody says, well, okay, to be an animal, if you're born as an animal, when do you get to come back up to the human realm? And it's just by dumb luck. Because an animal's life is spent in non-virtue. I mean, animals' whole focus is to hurt other animals. You know, their whole life is spent in the activity of trying to destroy other animals which provide them food. So, you know, then people say, well, Buddhism is very cruel, you know, or at least in Christianity, the birds are just ignorant, so, you know, they can still have their soul will still go to a nice place because they were just stupid. And Buddhism says, no, I mean, ignorance is no excuse, you know. It's exactly the kind of condition you never want to go to, because you'll get worse, things will get worse. If you're born as an animal and you spend your life seeking other animals to kill for your food, then the future is really lousy for you. And it's only by some kind of incredibly dumb luck that you ever get up to the human realm.
Good luck?
Well, good deed. But, you know, almost by some kind of accident that you undergo some kind of incredible suffering that wears out your bad karmas. And you have some tiny little seed for a good karma left, and then you go into a human realm. But they say that the beings going down, the Buddha taught this. He said the beings going down, he took a piece of dust and he showed it like this. He said the beings going up are like this dust, this moat of dust. And the beings going down are like the pieces of dust in the planet. You know, and he said that. It's in the sutra too.
How do you classify something like a zombie? Is that a bardo being?
What's that?
A zombie, you know, something.
Well, I never met one. But you mean like a...
A roll-on.
Oh, a roll-on. I think they would be a yuga.
A yuga?
A preta.
What is that?
It's like there's some kind of beings that like corpses that get back up and walk around. Supposed to be. There's a big debate about it. They say Nagarjuna wrote that book, and then other people say he never wrote it. Like that. So I think that covers yugas. Let me see. There's 36 types in the scriptures, and they're in your reading, okay? Galumba missed one, and I stuck it in from another book, which is the beauties of the computer. We'll do a very quick on animals, and then we'll stop. Animals don't take so much explanation, because you can see them. The cause is general cause. It's doing any one of those 10 bad deeds to sort of a wimpy extent. You did something like say you killed an insect by accident or something like that. Or you lied, but not with very strong intention, not to a very important object, not about something pretty important. And those would lead to an animal. They give Galumba, the Tenrin, and other scriptures give two specific reasons. Again, I don't quite like the word rules, but I don't know how else to put it. But it's like if you constantly break small things that are not very serious, but if you do it over and over again, you know, like you tell little white lies over and over again, then it would be a cause like that.
So
the
rules of karma.
Yeah, or rules of what you should do and what you shouldn't do, but should is a bad word. Should just means if you do it, you're going to end up like that. It's very interesting. Buddhist morality is pretty much, bad karma is defined as something that causes you to suffer. Bad karma is defined as something that brings you a result of suffering. And secondly,
are these subset of the 10 bad deeds?
These are two specific ones. These are two specific causes, and this is one general cause. So the Tenrin, by the way, Geshe Dolomba was a big master of the perfection of wisdom because his teacher, Lundan Sherab, was one of the great translators in Tibet, who translated many, many of the great books of the perfection of wisdom. So he himself, although we don't know much about him, we know he must have been affected by his teacher's thinking. And this is all based on the perfection of wisdom. So these are the two specific causes for anger. Then he goes into the suffering. The suffering, it's interesting because you and I tend to think of animals as something kind of cute. You know, like we have this dog at our temple who's very cute, Doma. And we have this chicken, the rooster that walks around outside. He looks really cute and he does funny things. And then you think of, what's that movie where the kid and the dolphin, Help Willie or something like that, you know. And you think of little rabbits and deer walking through the woods and, you know, and Geshe Dolomba says the same thing. It's very interesting. At the end of his presentation on animals, he says, what, do you think these animals are having a good time? You know, do you think they're just having some very romantic walk through the nice meadow and stopping to eat grass here and there, or the bunny is like communing with nature, and somehow, you know, in the great harmony of living things, he says, forget it. He says, being an animal is a lifetime of terror, and you're constantly. Why do animals run away when you approach them? You know, why do birds fly away when you come near them? Their whole existence is based on watching over their shoulder for the animal that eats them. That's their whole fixation in life. They're consumed with the task 24 hours a day of avoiding the animal that eats them. And they're just constantly on the run. They're constantly having to be alert and watchful. And the minute they're not, then they get eaten by the animal on the food chain behind them. And that's how they spend their lives. Don't think animals are these happy little creatures, you know. It's a dog-eat-dog existence, and it's an existence of sheer terror from the moment they're born to the moment they die, and they're just living like that. The general mass of animals are like that. Then there's this subcategory of animals that are you know, have the honor of being used by man, you know, and they have this special torture that humans are just. They're the property of humans. So the humans are raising them for food to slaughter them. The humans are trying to hunt them down to take their skins off. Or the humans are putting saddles on them and beating them and putting iron in their mouths and riding them and making them pull plows and then killing them when they get too old. And so there's a specific subclass of animals that have this added torture of being the property of human beings. So he says, you know, in general, it's just sheer terror to be an animal. And then more specifically, the ones that meet up with human beings get these special sufferings, these special tortures of being the property of a human being. Yeah.
I thought about that, and I'm wondering what the scriptures say about those that don't have so-called natural enemies, like polar bears that don't get eaten by anybody else, or
except humans.
Well, okay, and then also bugs. Like, I can't imagine a tiny bug feeling terror. I mean, like, do they feel terror?
I don't know. I watch them get chased by a butterfly, or what is bird, right?
Mm.
I mean, okay, the scripture, the Tenrin Chenmo, and the verse you're going to read there, it says, they all have their different personalities. He says, he admits, some of them are friendly, some of them are cruel, some of them are get along with each other, some of them, I mean, there are animals that have group instincts and they live in communities and like ants and they seem to get along with each other. Speaking generally, 99% are engaged in the act of watching out that they don't get killed today, you know. And then maybe there's a 1% which is somehow has a little window of comfort, you know. But on the whole, it's it's a realm that we don't recognize the terror of being an animal. We don't recognize the true nature of an animal as being the hunted and spending their whole lives watching for the thing behind them that's going to kill them. You know, that's the scriptures talk about animals like that. The scripture says there's 360 million species of animals. And they say on the human body alone, there are 80,000 different species living.
They said that there, yeah, before a microscope.
They said 80,000 different species are inhabiting the body, inside or on the body.
So bacteria causes animals?
Yeah. Yeah. Long story. They live in two places. We're almost finished, okay? If you're going to be a translator, this is a nasty word, okay? I mean, it's hard. It's very rare. Say jinna.
Jinna.
Nepa.
Nepa.
Jinna.
Jinna.
Nepa.
Nepa.
This means living in the ocean, okay? Living in the warm waters of the ocean, like the midst of the ocean. And what it means is that by, in terms of population, the vast number of animals live in the ocean. Okay? According to Buddhist scripture, if you count all the plankton and everything else, you know, little life forms that are living off of the salt water, that's where the vast majority of animals are living.
There's just an article in the Times about a month ago that scientists estimate 90% of the Earth's population lives in the middle zone of the Earth's ocean.
Yeah.
Not the bottom, but not the top, but in the middle zone.
Yeah. This means in the middle. Say katorwa.
Katorwa.
Katorwa. Katorwa means spread out all over the place. In the sky, in the waters, on the land, under the dirt. I mean, predators have their own little place somewhere. Half of them, say. And, you know, hell beings have a very specific place where they live. But this section of animals are just spread out all over the planet. They don't have you can't say, oh, this is where the animal realm is. It's spread out all over the planet.
In other realms too?
Not the former formless realm. Only Thoth. Only Devas in other realms. Yeah.
I was just curious, kind of digression, why is Jinnah Thoth?
Oh, just the word, you never, 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 ever see this word used anywhere else. It's a very specific word that means the middle of the depths of the sea. The depths of the sea. But I mean, if you try to find it in a dictionary or something, you'll never. It just happens to be like one word in a million, and you'll never find it. So there's arguments about what it means, but the scriptures are pretty clear. Yeah.
So these 360 million species just on Earth?
Yeah, in our world. It's unbelievable.
So this is around.
Yeah, it's a very good question, and I used to wonder. Yeah, apparently it's like a model that occurs. You know, every planet that has life has these six realms. I used to wonder that. And then sometimes you come across in scripture a plural. You know, like every world has this same basic structure. And every planet that has life has the same basic structure. Seems to be like that. Because they explain galaxies, then they explain universes, and then they explain macro universes in the Abhidhamma, third chapter, towards the end. And you know, those are groups of millions of planets, inhabited planets. They all seem to have the same structure. If they have life, they have the same structure, which just basically means that the possible, what do you call it, variations of karma are limited. You know, possible permutations. There's only so many permutations of karma. At the end of the animal section, he says, but actually, maybe the number of species is limitless because different kinds of karma are limitless. So I don't know. But I think the important thing is, you know, people read the Abhidhamma and they say, oh, this is just some weird idea about how the world is, you know. But the point is this, and the point of this whole class, the point of this whole course, is to realize that if the teachings on emptiness are true, if the teachings on emptiness are true, and if life is only a projection, then it's totally plausible that we could become any of these things the minute we pass over that threshold. that within 20 minutes from the moment we speak, one of us could be one of those things. Because it's a change in your perceptions, and it's not a, it's not like you have to go pull on a new body like a sock. It's that you will see yourself that way, the same way you see yourself now, with the same validity that you see yourself now. And it's totally possible, because it just depends on what kind of seeds are in your mind. So the whole point is to try to avoid those seeds. This is a death meditation. We already started it before we got to it.
Okay, that's all. We'll do a short prayer.
Oh, I have to make a short announcement. On Sunday, March 17th, I'll repeat, Ken Rinpoche, which is our root lama, very great lama, who rarely teaches, is going to teach out in New Jersey, 2 o'clock, it's a Sunday, and he'll continue to teach most Sundays, starting on the 17th of March. If you don't know how to get there, ask one of the monks, or some John knows, or a lot of people have been there. It's a very great teaching. He's going to teach from the Kadampas, like the very early Buddhists up to that. He's going to teach a text from that. On the 30th, which I think is a Saturday, he's just announced that he will be giving some layman's vows and some other things, some other neat things. So if you want to get in on that, let me know. Well, cancel it. That's at 2 o'clock. I think we better cancel that. Again, he's going to, on the 1st of June, there'll be a general sojourn ceremony, Bodhisattva vows and tantric vows. You have to memorize the text. I have the text up here. And someone has been, Rinpoche made a tape recording, and I have copies of the tape. And if anybody would like a copy of the tape, let me know after class, I'll give you a copy of the tape. It makes it easier to memorize it.
For the Bodhisattva vow, once you do that, do you have to memorize the text?
No, you can't. Not allowed.
Is there classes
Thursday? No. No class this Thursday. Next class is next Monday. Because we have a ceremony here this Thursday. Okay.
Thank you.